Again, thank you for being here this morning. David has welcomed you once, but I just want to thank you for being part of our worship this morning. You are going to start seeing, maybe as early as this week, this little area up here start to transform as Rochelle and her little gang of script people are getting ready for Camp Discovery. And so this is my last chance for probably a month to preach right here in this spot without all kind of cool stuff behind me. So we're looking forward to a great VBS. It's just a few weeks away. Thank you for all that you've already done, and I hope that you will continue to pray and keep that in your thoughts as we get closer and closer. It was probably 7 or 8 years ago that a number of people in our post-VBS meeting, so if you're not part of VBS, you know, at the end of Friday when everybody's exhausted, I think Beverly started this and Taryn kind of continues it. We all come in and have pizza and we debrief a little bit. And it's almost always an extremely productive, here's what's good, maybe here's a way, can we fix this? And it's always a really neat time, really. And about 7 or 8 years ago, one of the comments that was made in that debriefing meeting was, Doug, why don't you preach the stories that we teach at VBS? And all the teachers kind of ganged up on me. And you know, when you're ganged up on by a bunch of VBS teachers, you do what they say. And so ever since then, we've tried to at least highlight a few of the VBS stories that we're going to tell. And we're going to do the same thing for the next couple of weeks. And so I want to start with maybe the most famous Bible story, maybe outside of Noah and the Ark, in the Old Testament. But let me preface it with this short little story. His name was Patrick. Patrick was 2 years older than me. And he lived in the same apartment complex behind us and up three floors. And not only was Patrick 2 years older than me, I was a little diminutive for a little bit, and on the small side, and I was super skinny, and I still had plenty of Austin nose, so put all those things together, and there was Patrick. And Patrick's favorite thing was to give me a hard time every morning on the way to school. And my mom usually watches our sermon on Monday morning, but my mom probably never realized why I was always up so early to get out of the house so fast to go to school. It had nothing to do with the excitement of going to school. It had everything to do with beating Patrick so he didn't beat me. Because here's what would happen. If Patrick and I managed to go the same time, he was really good to wait till we got to this little park that we had to walk through. And then I would get mobbed by Patrick, and he would sit on me and sit on my arms, and he would take his knuckles and he would beat on my chest. And he'd say, I'm going to beat on your chest till you name 10 candy bars. Mercy is right, because he was way bigger than me. And now think about it. When you're under pressure, can you name 10 candy bars? Well, I certainly couldn't as a 7-year-old, and I'm not sure I could name 10 candy bars as a something else other than 7 now. But then I remember going to church. And we go to church, and you get in little kids' class, and this is totally theologically wrong, but you get into little kids' class, and the little Bible class teacher says, let's tell about the story of David and Goliath, and David was this little boy just like you. And I'm thinking, cool. And Goliath was this big giant man like the mean old bully that lives in your neighborhood. And I'm thinking, cool. And this whole story unfolds of this little tiny 10-year-old who whoops Goliath. Okay, first of all, if you have told the story that way, do not do it again. I hope to convince you by the end of this that David is not some 10-year-old or some freshman in high school who suddenly is this ingenious warrior. But I do want to convince you that it's still impossible odds. Because what we have in this story is a story that the reason our kids love it is because they feel David-ish every now and then. They feel like there's somebody bigger and badder and meaner than them in the neighborhood. And my guess is some of your kids have felt the same exact thing. But I'm also guessing that everyone else in this room that's not going to elementary school still has battles with the gigantic. And maybe the gigantic is the workplace bully. And there are workplace bullies. And maybe the gigantic is news that you get in a doctor's office. And maybe the gigantic is just the status of life in our world right now. And maybe the gigantic is you've got a prodigal child and you are going to the fence every day praying that they will come back. And maybe the gigantic is, and you can fill in what your giant is. And your giant may not be the bully, but you've got a giant. And in the midst of this world that we live in and the faith that we hold, the story of David and Goliath rings true no matter what that giant is. It can be the giant of addiction. It can be the giant of trouble. It can be the giant of hardship. But all of us have our own giants to face. And so maybe let's tell this story, I don't want to say differently, but I hope we tell this story a little more accurately than I heard it as the little kid in Bible class. Okay, here's how the story begins. There's this big guy. The big guy is a guy named Goliath. And what we have is you've got the forces gathered, and we're getting a little piece of a glimpse of what happens in warfare, basically, in the olden days. And when the olden days, I'm not saying World War II, I'm saying you go way back, and here's how you solve things. Often, if you had two nations that were feuding against each other, you could go to war and kill everybody, or you could send out your best, and they could send out their best, and you settle it that way. And whoever wins, wins, and you call it. That's kind of the way it seems to be lining up for Israel and the Philistines. You've got the Philistines on one side of this valley, and you've got the Israelites on the other side of the valley, and the Philistines have sent out their best warrior. And by all counts, he's the baddest man in town. Not only is he seasoned, and not only is he the best of the best, but he is, to use our word for the morning, he is gigantic. And then here is Israel. And what happens with Israel is they keep looking around at all of the other people, and my guess, all the other soldiers are looking at each other saying, who's good enough to beat this guy? I mean, this guy is bigger than us, and he's stronger than us, and he knows what to do better than us, and he's got history, and we've heard all the stories. And so the forces are gathered, and we get this. Goliath stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, why do you come out and line up for battle? I think that's David or Goliath's way of saying, why are you even bothering coming out here every morning? You're just a bunch of chickens. Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me, and if he's able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects, and you will serve us. And then the Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man. Okay, in Hebrew, that's kind of one little word, that phrase, give me. And it's put in a tense where it says, I dare you. Bring it on. And so he's the bully that's standing there in the middle saying, I dare you to take a swing at me so I can take a swing at you. So bring me a man and let us fight each other. On hearing the Philistine's words, Saul and the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. Okay, just think of some of the language there. They were dismayed. They were saying, "I not only dismayed kind of gives that idea of confused, gives the idea of wondering, gives the idea of what on earth is going on here, but then they throw in that terrified word. Have you ever been terrified? I know some of you have had moments when bad things happened in your life, and for a minute or two, or maybe for an extended period of time, you were terrified. One of you was telling me a story about the last time you traveled on a plane, and the plane hit one of those pockets, and you know, every now and then you hit a pocket in a plane, and the plane goes, and it feels like you're about to plunge to your demise, and you felt like for 25 minutes you were about to die, and it was, you know, probably 2 seconds, but you felt like you were about to die, and you were terrified. Well, Israel is living with that every single day. Because every single day they're coming out to say, okay, who's going to... And my guess is they're probably hoping Goliath will just go away. But every day they come out and they kind of line up and they look around and there's nobody to solve the problem. And they know it. See, that's the hardest part of this story is Israel keeps looking around at every other soldier, comparing them to Goliath, saying there is no chance. And they're scared to death. So David enters the story. David is sent by his dad to go take grain to the soldiers. And probably it's more to take grain to David's brothers and his group of soldiers. But David is on his way to deliver that. And we pick up the story again. Early in the morning, David left the flock in care of a shepherd. David's going to be a little ornery and disobey his father here. So kids, don't do that. That's not the amen I expected from you. Loaded up and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp and the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines and facing each other, and David left things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and asked his brother how they were. And I bet we didn't get the telling of that. As he was talking with them, Goliath the Philistine, champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. We're going to get some religious indignation here in a second. Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. Now the Israelites had been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out?" Now just hear the words of the soldiers. Hear how they come out. "He comes out and defies Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him, and he will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his family from taxes." And David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills the Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine?" And they repeated to him what had been said, and they told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." Okay, some writers think that David is in this for the glory of killing Goliath. Partly because it's based on that question. That it's almost like David arrogantly, and I'm going to take the other side here in a second, but maybe David arrogantly looks at his brothers and says, "Hey, what's going to happen to the guy that wins this? He's going to have it made, isn't he? I mean, he's going to get no taxes for his family, and he's going to get a woman out of it, and he's..." That sounded bad. I didn't mean for it to sound that way. He's going to get all of these great blessings that come out of killing this giant. And we think, maybe is this the beginning when David starts to hatch the plan? The question is David hatching the plan for his own glory? Or is David hatching the plan for the glory of God? So in the midst of this, the next part of our story is old Eliab, who is David's older brother, who is supposedly a pretty good warrior. If you read the lists of those warriors in the thing, Eliab gets angry, and then David goes to Saul, and we pick up our story. But David said to Saul, "Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it, struck it, and rescued the sheep from its mouth. When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair." Okay, so you got to be imagining the scene. "When it turned on me," so this is the lion. "When it turned on me, I seized it by the hair, struck it, and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine is like one of them, because he has defied the armies of the living God." Okay, that seems to be a word that keeps appearing. He has defied the armies of the living God. "The Lord rescued me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, and he will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." Okay, I don't want to read again too much into this story that we got to kind of piece some ideas in, but Saul has not yet been willing to go face Goliath himself. And we're going to talk more about Saul in a second, but remember, Saul is the soldier among soldiers. I mean, when we hear the story of Saul, the story is told that he is head and shoulders taller than everybody else. Okay, I'm not sure there's anybody in this room that is head and shoulders taller than me. I'm just kind of looking. Probably the closest is going to be David. And David isn't head and shoulders taller than me. So Saul is a giant among his own men. And yet David, this young soldier who's already done some pretty impressive things, will say, "Let's take care of this." And what's interesting is David is going to go to Saul, and Saul is going to say, "All right, God be with you." And I don't know whether he's saying, like, "Go get him, buddy," or if it's, "Oh, God help you." And it could go either way. But so David comes to Saul and says, "Here's what's going on, and here's this guy that's defying Israel." And Saul says, "Well, you're going to go equipped." And so he gives Saul his armor. Again, now remember, we got to imagine ourselves in the world context of Saul. Saul would have the very best armor of any soldier on the line. And so what Saul is offering David is he's offering David the best of the best. Because you know they're not giving faulty equipment to the king. And so they equip David with all of Saul's stuff. But we already have been told Saul is head and shoulders above everybody else. So nothing fits. And David says, nope, this isn't it. And then David goes to the river and he chooses, the text says, 5 smooth stones. Okay, let's pause there for a second. What David is about to do is not Dennis the Menace slingshot. He's not got a little stick that's got a little corner and 2 rubber bands, and he's aiming and going, ping. The text talks about some of the Benjamites. And in the story, as it talks about the Benjamite soldiers, it says they could knock down anything they wanted to from a long ways off with a rock and a sling. And David probably has trained in that same way. Now you imagine his life as a shepherd. So for a big chunk of David's life, he's been the shepherd and he's told the stories about how he's taken care of lion and bear. His best weapon was not a knife and the bear of the lion or the hair of the lion and taking them on one-on-one. His best weapon was when he saw the lion coming down the road to sling the rock. And so my guess is David is awfully good slinging a rock. And so here is Saul, and he's saying, why don't you do all this stuff that I would do if I had the courage to go up and do it? And here's my armor, and here's my sword, and here's all my good stuff. You equip yourself, and you go take care of business. And instead, what David says is, this isn't the way I do it. And this isn't how we're going to solve the problem. And I don't think David is arrogantly saying, I'm better with 5 stones in a sling, as much as David says, I'm not going to fight it his way, because that wouldn't work. I'm going to fight it in a way that God can ordain and bless. And so then we get the story. And we get, I think, the greatest sermon in the Old Testament. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. And he looked David over. Again, you got to close your eyes and see the sight. He looks David over and saw that he was little more than a boy. Okay, in Hebrew, that is, he was a young man. So that's part of where us thinking he's a 7th grader comes in. He was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome. The word is he's ruddy, which doesn't necessarily mean he's this little tiny prepubescent kid. So he's glowing with health and handsome, and the giant despised him. And he said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Okay, my guess is most other soldiers, the minute those lines start to come out of Goliath's mouth, they would say, okay, see you later. Saul, here's your stuff. Why don't you do it? So come here, he said, and I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. Which is a nice little Hebrew idiom saying, you're going to be food for everybody else. And David said, best sermon in the Old Testament. You come against me with sword and spear and javelin. But I come against you, in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the enemies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day, the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down, and I will cut off your head. This very day, I will give the carcass of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know, what does it say? That there is a God in Israel. And all of those gathered here will know that it's not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. And then the song that we just sang, for the battle is the Lord's. And he will give you to my hands. And then we know the rest of the story, right? David from there puts the rock in the sling, his very best weapon. God ordains it. Rock zings, hits Goliath. Goliath falls. And at least for an extended period of time, the Philistine problem is solved. Let's not underestimate David's courage. Let's not underestimate David's ingenuity to say, let's fight the battle this way. But let's also be really careful that we don't underestimate David's God. Because the one thing that I love so much in that sermon is David says, "Here is the Lord Almighty." In the midst of that story, he's saying, here's what matters. And Saul, who should have been the one to fight, is head and shoulders above everybody else, but he doesn't. And all he is determined to do is maintain. And to me, there's great victories in the story, and there's great sadness. And the story of Saul is part of the sadness. Because I believe if Saul would have said, "I'm the king, and I'm our best warrior, and there's their best warrior," he should have said, "Our God will take care of this." But he's happy just kind of maintaining. Because every morning the same thing keeps happening, and every morning instead of gaining ground against the Philistines, Saul is just saying, "Let's stay right here. They're not killing us yet." Instead of doing what God had called. And then the other thing that I find interesting in this story is never once does David call Goliath a giant. Never once in this story does David say, "Boy, you're a big fella." But David says over and over and over again, "Here is the Lord Almighty." Okay, my guess is none of you are walking out to the center of town with a slingshot against a warrior. But you've got your giants. And I think we need to have some courage like David. So in the midst of those battles that we have, that are probably and hopefully never literal, but certainly figurative, are we going to have courage like David? That when we're facing the giants of whatever it is, whether it's addiction or trouble or lostness or whatever it is that's on our horizon, how are we going to stand in front of that giant? Okay, just let me give you a couple things from this story that I think really brings it home to the world that we live in. First, gigantic courage rejects the status quo. Okay, the status quo, David says, forget that. David says, I'm not even one of the soldiers on the line right now. I'm the guy delivering the food. But we're not, the status quo's not working. And if we're going to keep on doing the same thing, you know, lining up here and looking down the row and looking down the row, saying who's going to go get him, if we're just going to keep on doing that, we're never going to gain ground. The status quo is not the answer. One writer said this. He said, David's greatest obstacle isn't Goliath. The greatest obstacle for David isn't the giant that keeps coming down to the middle of the valley and saying all these bad words. The greatest obstacle for David is the puny faith in his own camp. And how many times is the puny faith in our own camp? We keep saying, man, the world's bad out there, and we all this other stuff, and so we kind of hide in and we shelter in our little thing called the church, and I understand that to at least some degree. But never in the last 100 years has there been less churches in the world. Never. But the last 100 years, we've kind of watched the church just slowly just get smaller and smaller and smaller, and maybe it has peaks, and it has some moments where it starts to do good, but what we've done is we've said we see gigantic problems out in the world and we don't know what to do about it. And so we tend to come and hide in our little safe place. And we look down the row and say, who's going to fix it? And we look down the row and we say, who's going to fix it? Maybe the status quo needs to be dealt with. I think when we face gigantic problems with gigantic courage, and maybe even more than gigantic courage, with this deep abiding faith that says our God Almighty is more than able to deal with this, this injects something. Okay, what happens after this is, okay, so after David gets Goliath and knocks Goliath down, and we don't want to be too graphic, and does all the other stuff he's going to do, Israel suddenly says, we've got this. And Israel kind of gets their courage back and gets their fervor back, and they go out and they chase the Philistines all the way back to Gath, and the Philistines aren't a problem for at least a while. It injects God into the equation. And I think so often we look at all the problems that are going on, whether they are individual or whether they are corporate, and we say, here is the list of problems, and we can't fix it. Someone asked me about 6 months ago, how can you fix the problem of homelessness in Roswell? And I said, I have no idea. Because if I'm going to try to fix homelessness from my own perspective, I am not smart enough, I am not learned enough, I don't know enough about the social world of that area, I don't know anything when it comes to all of that. And if you were to say, okay, fix it, I'm going to say, I don't know. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. And that's what happens here. Is Israel is going to say, well, we can't solve it ourselves, so we're just going to maintain the status quo. And so in maintaining the status quo, we're just going to say, since we can't, it can't be. And when we've done that, individually or corporately, when we've done that, we have taken the God factor out of the equation. Okay, I think the church can solve a great many things. Let me just give you some examples. Go back the last 20 years and figure out every place there has been a hurricane that has wiped out places. Think New Orleans, think the East Coast, think Houston, think other places. It was the church that came in. The government did their part. I mean, it took them a while. But the churches came in literally on day one, and they were the ones bringing food, and they were the ones bringing water, and they were the ones rebuilding houses, and they were the ones helping people out. And they could have said, well, we can't solve this problem. But they said, well, maybe we can. The second thing is we need to learn that gigantic courage is placed in something far mightier than ourselves. There is no odd too big for God. Okay, I don't care if Goliath is twice David's size, which is probably fairly accurate. Those odds are still in David's favor because David's got God. And I don't care where you are in your world and what you're fighting on an individual or on a corporate level, the odds are still in our favor because of who's on our side. And I think we've got to be reminded over and over that the one who is in us, as John would say, is greater than the one who's in the world. Well, David would say it this way. I think it's probably later in his life. But David writes this from a psalm. Who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, you gates, and lift them up, you ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is he, this King of glory? The Lord Almighty, He is the King of glory. I wish we'd figure that out as the church. And I wish in those moments that we're privately fighting our giants, we would remind ourselves that we have the Lord Almighty on our side. Now, I think David knew this for a couple of reasons. One, David is called from a very young age a man after God's own heart. And that's significant. That's significant that the very first descriptive term given about David has nothing to do with his ruddiness, it has to do with his heart. And there's something about when our heart is aligned and our heart is attuned to God that we are not only reminded, but we believe in this God Almighty. So here's what I need you to do. If you want to win the battle against the giant, first, show up. Okay, stop living like things have to stay like they are. Okay, if you're wrestling with a personal giant, stop living like that just has to be the way it stays the rest of your life. Trust in something bigger and trust in something stronger, and then join up. That's what I mean by show up for the battle. Join up and do your part. Sometimes we live like there is nothing we can do, but I think there is. Let me give you a story that appears in Acts chapter 4. The apostles are in prison, or at least some of the apostles are in prison, and the Jewish leaders come to them, or bring them to them, and they say, I'm going to paraphrase and inject a few words, you've had a pretty rotten couple of days, and if you think this is bad, you just keep on doing what you've been doing. Okay, so the threat is made. Just like Goliath comes out and says, who do you got? They're looking at the apostles in jail and saying, okay, you've been treated pretty lousy the last couple of days, and this is just the beginning. And here's what the apostles say. Now, Lord, consider their threats and enable your servants to speak your word with great boldness. Stretch out your hand to heal and perform signs and wonders through the name of the Holy Spirit. Okay, so the bad guys in the story are saying, you think this is bad, you just wait. The good guys in the story are saying, let's pray this. Okay, we know that this is what they want to throw down upon us, but we're going to turn to you. Okay, I don't know what the world is going to throw down in your personal life. I don't know what the world is going to throw down on the corporate life of the church. I don't know what's going to happen the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. My guess is we're going to kind of keep going through some of the same stuff we're going through now. And our answer is not going to be, can we hide in our church and hope it goes away? The answer is going to be, now, Lord, we know what's going on out there, and you help us to speak your word with great boldness. So show up. But then speak up. I love the speech. I can't wait to go to the movie theater in heaven. I don't know if there's a movie theater in heaven, but I'm making a request. But can't wait to go to that, and I can't wait to see David give this little sermon. And I know that Goliath's got this sneer, and he thinks David's some ridiculous little punk. But in the midst of that, he speaks up, and he says, I'm going to defend the honor of my God. Okay, in the world where we live in, which is maybe for the first time in all of our lives, the least Christian it has ever been. And don't take that phrase lightly. This is the least Christian the world has ever been since Romans. Defend the honor of your God. That when the world is going to say your God is ridiculous and your God is a crutch and your God is a make-believe story that you lean on and your God is nothing but, and they fill in all the blanks, defend the honor of your God. Because the only one in this whole story from Genesis to Revelation that can make the enemy leave is the one whose side we're on in the first place. And then look around for your weapons. For David, it's a slingshot and five rocks. I'm not asking you to look for a sword, but I'm asking you to look for where the battle belongs. I love the song we sang. In heavenly armor we'll enter the land. The battle belongs to the Lord. See, David's victory becomes Israel's victory because it is God's victory. So your victory can become the church's victory because it's God's victory. Because it doesn't start with us. It doesn't mean we don't have a part, and it doesn't mean we don't show up, and it doesn't mean we just stand idly back and say, go, God, go. But it means we say, what is my part in this? And then I'm going to trust in the one who can win. Let's go back to the story we started with. When I was in third grade, the greatest thing happened to take care of Patrick. And it wasn't that Patrick moved. So we had a family that moved in next door to us that was named the Hulls. And they had like 52 kids. And they had one kid younger than me and one kid older than me. And Danny Hull looked like he could have played college football in elementary school. And I said, I'm walking to school with you. Patrick never bothered me again. You got something way better than Danny Hull standing next to you. And let's believe that the battle belongs to him. And let's stand behind him and let's stand next to him when it's called for. And let's say, God, you've got this. How can I help? The world needs churches to do exactly that. So let's be it. We're going to start when we get 200 kids in here. Only of which 50 of them know anything about Jesus. Let's go because the battle belongs to the Lord. So we're going to sing another song. It's our song of encouragement. If you need me, if you need the elders, I'm going to be right there. Elders will be at all the doors as you're going out. If you need us, call upon us. If you're ready to be baptized and say, I'm ready to enlist, so to speak. We used the battleship image last week. If I'm ready to join the side that's God's, then we'd love to celebrate that too. So if you need us, let us know. Kent, let's sing.